Everybody, nice to see all of you. So this is a course on quantum spin simulations. My name is Anders Sandvik. So today I just want to start by giving some general overview of quantum spin systems, and actually that's going to be pretty much this first week, I think, maybe 4 days or something like that. The main theme of the course is computation, you know, simulations. But I think it's pointless to just start talk about the calculations unless we know, you know, something what these systems are, where they come from, why they are useful, and so on. So I'm really going to start quite slowly talking about the models that later on we want to study computationally and look at various computational algorithms. So including also some simple analytical calculations. And there will be more details in the tutorials that Dennis will give in the afternoons. So I will state some results, and later on you will do your calculations yourself, fill in the details and so on. And in these introductory lectures I also want to talk about some related classical physics, because, okay, we are interested in quantum spin systems, but there's also classical spin models, of course, and that's an older field, but still an active field. But, of course, there are many, many similar aspects and so on, so it's good to look at some issues first in the context of the classical models. And I should say that, you know, we have a lot of time. We have 15 hours. So I want to go slow, and if you feel like you want to ask a question at any time, just fire away. It's just really good if you ask a lot of questions. That helps me also to gauge, you know, what I should focus more on and so on. Okay, so this is about the first week. I want to give just a brief introduction now, and then I want to talk a little bit about the models so that we know what we are talking about, and then I will give a more complete overview of what we are going, but just briefly now what we are going to do in this course. So after this introduction, we will switch to calculations, and basically we are going to look at two classes of computational techniques. So the first one is what's called exact diagonalization. Actually, I'm not even sure why people use exact here. It's really numerical diagonalization. So basically, if you have a small system, quantum spin system, or any other lattice system for that matter, you can just write down the Hamiltonian as a matrix, diagonalize it, and you get full information about your system in that way. So we're going to talk about full diagonalization, where you look for all the states, and the so-called Lanczos method, where you get just the low energy states. This is also really useful not only for quantum many-body physics, but in many physics problems and engineering and so on, you need these matrix diagonalization methods. So this is quite useful for other things as well. And also now, when we look at this diagonalization, as I said, we can really just look at very small systems, because the size of the Hilbert space grows very quickly. So it's mainly useful to look at one-dimensional so-called spin chains, right? So we will use results of diagonalization also to discuss the physics of spin chains in one dimension. Okay, so this is, you know, pretty much the first week. This will maybe also be 3 or 4 days. And then the last topic, which is, I think, the most exciting aspect of quantum spin simulations, is quantum Monte Carlo, which is an extension of classical Monte Carlo, of course. And it's my understanding that you have done something on classical Monte Carlo, I think, in your general computational course.
Dealing with Ising spins.
With Ising spins, okay. That's very useful. But actually, I will talk a little bit about classical Monte Carlo simulations also this week. I know you have done it, but I want to use it for some purpose, and you will see later on. So there will be some overlap there. And okay, then we want to extend the Monte Carlo method to quantum systems. And there are actually many ways to do that. There are many different quantum Monte Carlo methods, quantum Monte Carlo algorithms. And I want to cover two classes. So I'm going to start by just doing the formalism of path integrals. You probably have seen this before, but maybe not in exactly this formulation for lattice models, but I'm sure you know a lot about path integrals. So this is a formulation of quantum statistical mechanics. I also want to do another formulation, which is based on a series expansion, really. But it's actually quite related to the path integral in the end. And it's within that formalism that it's actually a little bit easier to study spin systems, so we will use that formulation. Then we will also look at ground states of spin systems using the valence bond basis. And valence bond is basically a two spins in a singlet. It's quite an interesting basis as a complement to the standard basis of up and down spins for spin one halves. So we will look at that as well. And then the last, I don't know, 2-3 days of the course, something like that, I want to talk about quantum phase transitions. And this is, you know, going all the way up to ongoing research, so I hope you will find this quite exciting. So I really want to go from really the basics up to ongoing research, at least give you a flavor of what's going on, but really more than a flavor, because as you will see, these techniques, for example, these quantum Monte Carlo methods, in the end, they are actually quite simple, right? And I'm not saying that they're simple because I'm sort of an expert in the field or anything. No, they really are simple. The programs that you will see that we will work on have maybe the core simulation part of those programs is maybe 100 lines. I mean, you can really write it from scratch and understand exactly what's going on. So that's, I think, one appealing aspect of this field, that you are not dealing with some program libraries with, you know, 50,000 lines and you don't know what's going on there. You can really know what's going on. And if you are interested, maybe you can also find out how to go beyond what we can do today, because the sad fact is that we cannot apply these methods successfully to all systems we want to look at today. There's a huge room for improvements of methods and so on, and to be able to do that, if somebody is going to make some progress in that, you need to know, I think, some details of existing methods. So that's the point of this. Okay, let's review classical spins. I know you know what classical spin models are. I think you have seen it in courses here. So we have a lattice, and on the vertices of this lattice, we have spin degrees of freedom. And in the classical case, those could be just Ising variables, like I think you have seen. For example, on each side, we can have a spin up or down, and we can just say, okay, the sigma I is plus 1 or minus 1. In principle, we could have more than two states. This is just the simplest and most often used case, but one could have Ising models with any number of spins, and they're so-called POTS models you may have heard about, which is like a generalization of Ising models as well. Okay, we can also have vector spins. We can have the planar model or the XY model, where these spins sit just in the plane. So we can, instead of their X and Y components, we could also just use this angle for the vector. So normally, but not always, but normally we would have a fixed length of these vectors. So for example, the length S of the vector could be set to 1. One can also study soft spin models where the length itself is fluctuating and you just have a term which enforces some average length, but normally we consider fixed. Okay, well, there's also the Heisenberg model where the vectors are three-dimensional, right? So it's going from a discrete to planar to 3D vectors. And of course, what we are interested in is in the statistical mechanics of these spins. So if we don't denote the spin configuration C, we have some energy as a function of those spin configurations. And we are interested in some quantity or the expectation value of some quantity at some temperature. And normally, since we are theorists after all, we set KB to 1. That makes life much easier, right? So, just classical statistical mechanics, we want to evaluate if we have a discrete set of configurations. This is a sum. Of course, if you have x, y, or Heisenberg spins, this would be an integral, and this is the partition function. And that's classical statistical mechanics. Now, of course, the crucial thing here is what is this energy? So in the Ising model, as you have seen, it's in principle, it runs over all pairs of spins, and you have some coupling j, ij, which could be anything between the spins. But as you know, normally in the standard Ising model, these neighbors are restricted to nearest neighbors. I mean, these pairs are restricted to nearest neighbors. But one can go beyond that, and that gives a much richer behavior in terms of what are the finite temperature properties. What are the lowest energy states. If you have a ferromagnetic Ising model, for example, we know that the lowest energy state is all spins pointing the same direction. When we put some more complicated interactions, let's say frustrated interactions, where not all the bond energies can be minimized at the same time, we can get more complicated situations. We can have huge degeneracies of the ground state, so the ground state is not unique, etc., etc. Okay, in the XY model, normally we will write it as this. We just take S dot S and write it as a cosine of the angular difference. And in the Heisenberg model, it looks the same, but here these are three-dimensional vectors, and I could characterize those by two angles, but I didn't write down that here. Okay, this is all familiar to you, I think. So now we go to quantum spin systems. So then the difference is, of course, that these entities that sit at the lattice sites, they are no longer classical numbers or classical vectors. They are some operators. And those operators act on some basis states. So normally we choose a quantization axis, and we call that Z normally. So a state would have n of these eigenvalues of the Z components of the spin operator. So for spin S, these SZs can go among these values. And the spin operators, of course, satisfy some commutation relations. And, okay, you have seen these before. These are the commutation relations between the spin operators that we have to worry about. It's useful to introduce these ladder raising and spin raising and lowering operators. I'm sure you know all about these as well. So the raising operator is Sx plus Sy, and the lowering Sx minus Isy. So when you raise a state, it really you just add one to the expectation value, and you have this pre-factor, and the lowering, you lower the spin. And of course, these are such that if you try to raise the spin above S, you get zero, and if you try to lower below minus, I just noticed I missed a minus sign there. If you try to lower below minus S, you also get zero. Yep.
The definition of SI plus J, is it I in front of SI?
Here, no. Here it's no I. So this should, right. Yep, you're right. There should be an idea because it should be real. Good, thanks. We also have this important spin squared operator. Now, normally when you represent these eigenstates of spin or of angular momentum in general, of course the eigenvalues you say are S and M. So here instead of M, I just call it SZ. And I don't even write the S here, because here, normally, the S of the spin is fixed, right? You have a spin 1/2 on each side of spin 1. It's not ever going to change from a spin 1 to a spin 1/2, although one could make such models as well. So I don't even write the S here explicitly. But so if you take the total spin squared on site I and act on that state, you get this S times S plus 1. So here S refers to the spin of all these guys. They all have spin S. Of course, one could consider also some case where you have spin 1/2 and spin 1s mixed and so on, but let's not go to that situation. Okay, so normally we will actually look at spin 1/2 spins. In most of what we are going to do for the computations, we will look at just spin 1/2. So then these rules are, of course, very simple. So then we can call the plus minus 1/2. Normally, of course, we call up and down, right? So this is what the notation we will use, up and down. And then we have just have the diagonal operators on those. Of course, they give plus minus 1/2. And then the raising and lowering operators, they just are very simple. No factors in front here at all. Okay. So now those are the states and operators, and now we have to look at the Hamiltonian. So like in the classical case, one can study a wide range of different Hamiltonians, and here are three main classes. Again, Ising, XY, and Heisenberg, exactly like the classical case. Yeah?
Are we assuming that the quantization axis Z is perpendicular to the lattice plane?
Actually, we don't need to make any such assumptions. In a real material, it will be something like that because there are some anisotropies and so on. But if you just imagine that you have a lattice, an idealized lattice, and these spins sit on these lattices, the spin space and real space are completely unrelated. So you don't have to really worry about that. I mean, the components are in the spin space, and okay, the lattice is there, but that's just basically there to tell us how these spins interact with each other. But it's a good question. It can be confusing. I remember when I started on this, you know, a long time ago, at some point I was confused about that, but they are completely independent coordinate systems in the absence of any other fields that will somehow couple them.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. But in materials, normally, you know, there would be something which couples them. Okay, so one difference here that you should keep in mind when we talk about Ising and XY and Heisenberg in the quantum case is that the spins, these operators that we are dealing with, they really always have three components. In the classical case, we could say, well, Ising, that's just plus minus one, and then we go to planar vectors or XY. Or three-dimensional vectors. But here the vectors, these operators are always have all their three components. And it's only in the interactions that we may have an interaction which involves only one component or only two components or three components. And that would determine how we call this model. So, for example, the quantumizing model would look like that, with just the Ising term here. Now, I can relate this back to these classical Ising spins plus minus one. If I just put a quarter in front, I could also say that this is the Pauli spin Z operator, right? And that's it, but this doesn't mean that we don't have X and Y components. The X and Y spin components are still there. But, of course, this is completely diagonal in our chosen quantization, in our chosen basis. So, in practice, it's completely equivalent to the Ising model as long as we are just dealing with Z components. But in principle, even in a quantum Ising model, we could measure some correlations, let's say, in the X and Y direction, and they are there, but they would not be very interesting because they are, like, completely independent things. If we go to the XY model, then this looks like that, and we can write it in terms of the ladder operators. But again, there is definitely a Z component there as well, and in this case, you know, that may even be, there may be even some interesting aspect of that component, which does not appear in the energy, but it's still there. So here I didn't add any external magnetic fields or anything like that. Of course, we can also do that, but this is just the most simple variance. Yes, please.
What is the advantage of writing the SX plus SY terms using the ladder operator?
Because the ladder operators are very simple if you use this basis, the action of those operators on the states is very simple. And that's going to be more clear when we start to actually do some computations or even in some analytical calculations that we want some very simple relationships between the state before and after you act, right? So, and in Heisenberg we have the off-diagonal term like that and the diagonal term. And again, we are interested in statistical mechanics, but now it's quantum statistical mechanics. So now an expectation value of some operator is, of course, the trace of this Boltzmann operator now, or density matrix, whatever you prefer to call it. So we can write these down as matrices, then H would be a matrix and Q would be a matrix, and we have to take the trace of it. And the Z is just the trace of e to the minus h times h over t. And now, of course, if we do know the eigenstates and energies of the system, it looks very much like in the classical case. The partition function is just the sum over all these Boltzmann probabilities corresponding to the eigenstates. And we could write something similar there. But the Hilbert space is large, right? So if we have a spin system of n sites, and let's say we have a spin 1/2 system, then the number of states is 2 to the n, which of course is exactly the same as in a classical Ising model. But the problem is that we have a very hard time to actually compute the eigenstates and energies. So we don't really know what these energies are. And to compute some expectation value, we also would need to know what the states are. So we cannot really trivially write it like that. Except, okay, we can do exact diagonalization or numerical diagonalization, which we'll talk about, which this is really what we do. We write down these matrices. We diagonalize the Hamiltonian and compute this exactly, straightforwardly, like that. But since the Hilbert space grows in size so fast, this matrix that we have to deal with, which is, of course, of size 2 to the n squared, except we will talk about how to use symmetries and so on to block diagonalize it, but still it will quickly become such a big matrix that we cannot do anything. So that's the difficulty. And as I said, in the classical case, and as you have seen, you have dealt with Ising models and so on before. So let's say you have the Ising ferromagnet. There's no doubt whatsoever what is the lowest energy state of the Ising ferromagnet, right? It's all spins up, all spins down. That's it. Well, let's say you have an Ising antiferromagnet. Well, then you, in two dimensions, you have the checkerboard pattern of spins, right? Those are the low energy configurations. Now, if you take a quantum, let's say a quantum Heisenberg model, so this model, and you make it ferromagnetic, and you just, let's say, use nearest neighbor interactions. Again, it's quite trivial what the lowest energy state is. Well, there are many of them, but one is all the spins in your basis pointing in the same direction, so all spin up and all spin down, for example. Those are lowest energy states, okay? So in that case, the ground state is also quite trivial. But actually, the excitations are still not trivial. Even in a ferromagnet, the excitations, well, you can write down the lowest energy excitations, but if you want some more excitations, it's not so easy. Well, in the case of the antiferromagnet, this staggered configuration of the spins up, down, and so on in one dimension, those are not even eigenstates. So in general, in the quantum case, it's also a challenge, often actually the biggest challenge, to find the ground state, even if the classical model has a very easy ground state, very simple ground state. When you go to the quantum model, you may get a very non-trivial ground state, and one of the things that we would like to do is to actually find the ground state. Okay, so now I have introduced our main actors in this game. So now let's go back a little bit and motivate, well, why should we study these guys? Yes, please.
Why would you assume t goes to zero?
Well, we don't need to assume, but that's often one thing that we want to do, because Often the interesting physics happens at very low temperatures. So we have some coupling, let's say J. These are some typical couplings, so let's say J, we have some coupling J. Often some interesting things happen at low temperatures. There could be some ordering, phase transitions, and so on in the models and also in the real system. So now I want to get to why we are interested in these things. But here I'm not saying that we have to let the temperature go to zero, but that's... maybe I misunderstood your question. I see here now. Okay. So maybe you're asking, well, can we not just compute the ground state? We don't even need to do this finite temperature formalism. That's true. So you can say, well, I'm just interested in the ground state. I don't even need to use this formalism. That's true. And in fact, we will talk about ground state methods that don't use this formalism. But actually, often, even if you're interested in the ground state, it can be useful to use the finite temperature formalism and then just try to do it at very low temperatures. So, we will see examples of that. All right. Any other questions before I go on with the motivations here? So those are the models, and why should we study such models? Well, I have a whole page of reasons here. Okay, the most evident reason, of course, is in solid-state physics. So we have, I will do more details later, but just say quickly now. For example, we have many MOT insulators, meaning that they are insulating because of electron interactions, and you have unpaired localized electronic spins there, for example, in the high TC cuprets. That's probably the most famous example of this. And those spins interact with each other, and often the interactions are really of that Heisenberg form that I just talked about, but it can be different. And we would like to know what are the magnetic properties of those systems. So we need to model them, and that's how why we study spin systems. So there's a huge diversity here in terms of, what are the lattices? You know, there are many types of crystals, right? And what even the interactions, effective interactions are between the spins. And one sort of hot topic in condensed matter physics is really to look for exotic quantum states, meaning quantum states that are unusual in the sense that they may not have any classical counterparts. So often when we think about states, we want to compare it to something we know, and often what we know has to do with classical physics. But there are states of quantum spin systems, such as spin liquids, which don't really have good classical analogs. So that's one topic in condensed matter physics. Now, recently, these systems have become interesting also in the field of ultra-cold atoms, especially in optical lattices. So people in that field, they right now try very hard, actually, to engineer their systems to realize spin Hamiltonians. And then you can say, well, what's the motivation for that? Well, the motivation really often goes back here, that maybe we can engineer some effective systems for these condensed matter systems, and maybe in the context of optical lattices, we have more freedom in terms of changing the interactions and all kinds of things, and we could get insights easier into these systems than doing experiments on the solid-state systems. And it should also be said that even if you look at just bosons in optical lattices, if we want to model those bosonic models actually are not too different from spin systems. So, for example, if we have hard-core bosons, meaning that in each lattice site, you can have zero or one boson. there's a very simple mapping between those states and spin states, spin 1/2 states. As you can imagine, it's just two state system, so there should be some simple mapping. Okay, let's go on. Quantum information theory and quantum computing. Of course, if we want to build a quantum computer, we have to realize the qubits in some way. And the spin 1/2, of course, is a quite ideal realization of a qubit. So many realizations would use some kind of interacting spin systems. And again, then we have some Hamiltonian, and we may be interested in, maybe in that case, it's more the dynamics, the time evolution of the spins and so on. But regardless, it's a quantum spin system. And actually, one should say that a lot of these concepts that are studied in quantum information theory, like entanglement, those are really studied in the context of quantum spins as well. So in the last few years, there has been a lot of interaction actually between the fields of quantum information and solid state and also ultra-cold atoms, and a sort of exchange of concepts and methods and so on, and it's quite fruitful. And spin systems really are the main actors there as well. Well, another reason to study them is really that it gives us some generic many-body insight. So the spin systems are, of course, simpler than, for example, the full problem of interacting electrons, right? So a lot of questions related to collective quantum behavior, like quantum phase transitions, which we will talk a lot about, they may be much easier to explore in the setting of quantum spin systems, because it's just so hard to study the full electronic problem. So often we will look at models that, if we look up here in solid state physics, we would say, well, that model, maybe we cannot really have a physical realization of that model. But if we just want to study some phenomena and look at some physical concepts, they can still be very useful. So in a sense, what we would like to do is to identify Ising models of quantum mechanics. So you know that the Ising model has been very important in classical statistical mechanics just to develop the whole field of phase transitions and so on. And what we want to do is to find quantum spin systems that are sort of the simplest systems that would realize some phenomenon, and that would be like an Ising model for that quantum phenomenon. So we will in this course look at some aspects of this also. Okay, now let's go even further. So I think most people that participate in your course here are maybe interested in not so much condensed matter and so on, but maybe more field theory, quantum gravity, things like that. Maybe those of you who are here are more inclined in this direction. But nevertheless, it should be noted that a lot of phenomena, or at least some phenomena in quantum spin systems, have some analogs or parallels in high energy physics as well. So for example, there's this issue of spin on confinement or deconfinement at the phase transition, and that has some connections with confinement, deconfinement in gauge theories in particle physics as well. And I hope I will have time to actually tell you about some ongoing research in this field. Okay, here I also wrote spin foams, which you may know is some class of systems that people are interested in quantum gravity. I actually don't know what they are really, but they have some vague connection to quantum spin systems, I believe. So the point I want to make here is that even if you are not a solid state physicist or really interested in let's say, materials, there's a lot of reason to learn about quantum spin systems and computations with quantum spin systems. There are connections to all kinds of fields, and the methods will be useful in many contexts of and subfields of theoretical physics. So I hope you will find this course useful, regardless of what your research interests are. Any questions related to that? Right. Okay, let me try to say a little bit more about what I hope to achieve and what I hope you to achieve in this course. So, since the title of the course is Quantum Spin Simulations, simulations refer to computations, model studies, I do want to discuss spin systems from a computational perspective. But I don't want it to be completely focused on the computation. So, as I already said before, we actually get into details of numerical algorithms and so on. I want to give a quite thorough introduction. And it's actually very nice to give a course which is so long as this one. I mean, normally if I lecture at a summer school or something like that, maybe it's a five-hour course or something, and there's really not time to do all the introductions that you would like to do and which would, I think, benefit the audience. So now I think I really have time to do that, and I want to try to make it rather complete. But I do hope you continue asking questions as well, because it's a little bit hard for me to know exactly, you know, what you know, what you don't know. Judging from the schedule in this course, I think you know a lot, actually. So I'm not worried that you cannot follow, actually. This will probably be one of the simplest courses in some sense, I think. So I want to do some analytical calculations as well. But actually, most of the details will be done by Dennis in the tutorials. And then we will do some related classical physics also in this introductory part, as I already said. Actually looking at Ising models again, but maybe in a slightly different way than you did before. Okay, now when we finally then get to looking at calculations and so on for spin systems, we will really focus on the spin one-half Heisenberg model. So this is one of the simplest models, and it's also the most important model. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on within that class of model, and now here I say spin one-half Heisenberg model and its extension. I mean, it's a huge class of models, really, because its properties depend on what is the lattice, what is the range of the interactions you include, and all kinds of things. So it's really a rich set of models, especially when we go to extensions. Of course, extension can mean anything, right? So I will talk about a couple of extensions. Normally, we will look at one-dimensional chains and two-dimensional square lattices. So I like square lattices. I can visualize what they look like. I mean, there are all kinds of interesting lattices, but I always get confused if the unit cell has more than one or two spins. So we will stick to the simple lattices here. Okay, methods I already mentioned. I should stress here that what we'll look at is finite lattice methods. So in most cases, the goal of the calculations we will do will be to get an unbiased result for finite lattices, so essentially exact results. And then we want to do a series of lattice sizes and try to extrapolate the behavior to infinite size. And that extrapolation, finite size scaling and so on, is very well defined if you look at phase transitions and so on. There are well understood scaling properties at phase transitions, and those will be reflected in the behavior as a function of lattice size as well, so one can use those techniques, and that's what I want to discuss also here in the introduction, finite size scaling methods. So most of what I want to talk about is unbiased, by which I mean there's no approximation, that it's numerically exact. Of course, when we do Monte Carlo simulations, we have some statistical errors, some error bars. So our result will be exact to within the error bar. But there's no uncontrolled approximation. So in principle, if we have done everything correctly, we should be able to say that this is the definite result for that model. Okay, sometimes it's not easy because maybe we need to go to very large lattices before we can really trust what we are doing, but this is the goal. I do want to discuss also at least one example of a variational method where we design a wave function of a particular class and then try to find the best, meaning the lowest energy wave function within that class. But that's also in the context of quantum Monte Carlo, actually. Now, when we do start to talk about methods, I do want to talk about algorithms in detail and also the computer implementation.
Solid state physics a little bit more. is normal, but what we're mainly interested in is the interactions that we typically get in materials with these localized spins of an antiferromagnetic nature. And this is the prototypical example, right? These high temperature superconducting cuprates. This is just one example of it, the lanthanum copper oxide. So there are these, and I'm sure you have seen this many times before, so but anyway, let me review it. We have these copper oxygen planes, right, and between there are some other atoms. So these planes, in most respects, are quite insulated from each other electronically and magnetically. So most of the physics takes place within the planes, right? And I don't want to get into too much details about, okay, what is the electronic structure of these orbitals and all that. But the only thing we need to know here is that on the copper sides, you have essentially localized spins. So you can think of an electron, the unpaired electron on the copper side is something which is not completely localized to its own copper side. It can fluctuate, and in fact it's the fluctuation which eventually gives rise to this antiferromagnetic interaction. But there is one unpaired spin per unit cell here, and the system is insulated, so that implies that the electrons are somehow localized. We will understand this more when you do this afternoon the calculation related to this. So if we go through this kind of game, you say, okay, let's say I have an antiparallel pair of nearest neighbor spins. Then since these electrons are not exactly localized here, we can have processes like this where the electrons momentarily are doubly occupying the same orbital, and that costs some energy. So there's a basically Coulomb repulsion, right, which will make this a high energy configuration, if you will. And from those high energy configurations, we can go back to low energy configurations where we have just these singly occupied sites. And you can see this can happen in two ways. Either we go back to the same configuration, or we switch the spins. And if you do this carefully, you can derive the Heisenberg model. I will talk a little bit more about that today, but this is just qualitative now. So this will be to lowest order, this will be the effective interaction between these spins here. And in this case, the size of this coupling in temperature units is 1500 Kelvin, roughly. And it's the spin 1/2 less than the model, of course, because these are individual electronic spins. So this is one example. Of course, this is before we dove these materials. So this is the insulating parent compounds of the high-PC superconductors. In a moment, I will say something about what happens when we dove these systems. But before that, let me just point out that there are lots of other systems which are related to these cuprates. So if you look at these planes, and now let me just neglect these oxygen orbitals here. So these dots here just correspond to the copper sites which have the spins on them. There are materials where these two-dimensional square lattice planes are broken up into what's referred to as ladders for obvious reasons. And those ladders are coupled to each other in a way which actually makes the coupling quite weak. So you see here that there are these 45 degree bonds here. So if you think in terms of these orbitals, the overlap is actually much less between between these ladders is much lower than within the ladders. So through the leading approximation, we can treat these as independent ladders.
But do the coupling in the ladder themselves, do they have the same effect as the one over there?
Right, so within the ladder, it's pretty much the same physics, right? But then it turns out that the properties of these ladders depend very sensitively on how many chains you have in each ladder or how many legs you have in each ladder. So there's an even odd effect, which is quite interesting and also in the end quite easy to understand. And we will talk about that when we talk about calculations. We'll use this as an illustration. Another thing one can do is to do some substitution of these coppers. Actually, here I switched the labels. I see the red ones should be copper, and the blue ones here should be zinc. And on zinc, there is no unpaired spin. So doping with zinc corresponds to more or less taking out some of these spins at random. So you just have a vacancy instead of a spin. And there's quite a lot of interesting physics going on. You can look at isolated impurities or finite concentration. That's just an example of a related problem related to these high PC cuprates. And of course, you can, for example, this dilution, you can do in other systems as well, such as one class of problems. So let me just say a few words about doping the cuprates. We will not really talk about doped antiferromagnets, but this is very interesting, and at least you should know a little bit about it, and probably you most of you have seen something like this before. So what I should have mentioned before is that so what I have used here is really a whole picture. So if you think in terms of electrons, these oxygen orbitals should actually have two electrons on them, and the copper side should have one electron, and then one does a particle hole transformation, so you say instead of two electrons on the oxygen side, you have no hole, right? And on the copper, okay, you have one hole, and the hole is associated with the spin. That's easier than to keep track of two electrons on each oxygen. Now what happens then when you dope is that primarily you get holes on the oxygens, and that will also then liberate a spin on the oxygen. So in this picture when you dope, you will get additional spins there. But then, okay, then one normally simplifies the models further. So what you do? Yes.
I don't understand the doping and the addition of the zinc atom. Like when you exchange a copper atom for zinc atom.
Yeah.
Is that what you call doping?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I should clarify that. So this is one kind of doping, but this doping does not make it superconducting or even conducting. So this doping just affects the spins in this plane. So when you dope it to make it superconducting, you actually dope these lanthanums. So you can replace lanthanum by strontium, for example. So you do something there between the copper oxygen sheets. And that introduces, that sucks out electrons from the plates. Yeah, that's a good point. So this zinc doping doesn't do anything like that. It's just like taking out an electron, but it's still insulated. There's nothing that can move, because these zinc atoms, they just sit there, right? They don't move. So when I talk about doping with holes, that's really keeping the same atoms here, but just sucking out some electrons. So if we give this kind of picture, that's often called a three-band Hubbard model, because we have these three sites, three atoms per unit cell here, and there are three electronic bands corresponding to those. But then people do a mapping where we try to say, okay, if you only need to keep the lowest band. So then you can think of the, if you dope it and you liberate a spin there, that spin can form a singlet with one of these spins, and we can create that as a whole. I don't want to get into too much detail here because it's not the main topic of the course, but basically that's why people are looking at the so-called one-band Hubbard model, which is an electronic model where you just keep one side per unit cell, and you can think of it as a copper side, but it should really be thought of as a combination with the neighboring oxygens as well. But the point is that in the Hubbard model, we really have electrons that move. In the spin system, only the spins can flip, but there's always one electronic charge on each side. But in the Hubbard model, the electrons can really move. So for example, we can have a doubly occupied side, which then is a non-magnetic side, because it has to be an up spin and a down spin if you are going to doubly occupy it. And then we have a hole, and these things can move around. So the Hamiltonian describing that has a kinetic energy, which describes these hopping processes, and then there's a repulsion U, which captures the energy cost of doubly occupying one side. Okay? What one can do next is to say, well, U is very large. If U is very large, this is going to be quite rare, the doubly occupied side. And then one can instead just take the double occupation into account perturbatively, and which we will do later as well. And one can derive a spin interaction exactly like in the Heisenberg model. But now there's also a hopping, and now you should think of a hopping of the holes. So there's a kinetic energy which can move around the holes in this lattice, and there's a spin interaction between neighboring spins. So, of course, in the materials, what happens as a function of this kind of doping, so here I didn't really, well, I did show doping, so here you see there's one less electron than psi, so this is a dope case. So, of course, if you dope enough, you get the famous high-temperature superconductivity. If you just dope up to a couple of percent or something, you still have this antiferromagnetic order. So for very low doping, you have some holes there, but they are not yet mobile. They are localized, although one can probably understand a lot of these physics just based on spins. Now, here, between is a phase which is quite ill understood, and if you look at phase diagrams for IPC materials, sometimes you see that this antiferromagnetic phase is touching the superconducting phase here, and sometimes you see a gap between. And it's still not quite clear what this is, but it's quite an interesting situation. I don't want to get into details, but this is an STM picture of the electronic density of states, and the picture is not very clear maybe for you to see, but one can resolve individual atoms, and one can see that there's some kind of stripes or crystalline pattern that is forming there, but it's very disordered. So there's a lot of disorder effects, which it may be intrinsic or extrinsic. It's not really quite clear. Okay, we will not talk about doping in this course. We will look at antiferromagnets, but we will also look at phase transitions of the antiferromagnet into other states. So here you can see we have maybe here three or four different kinds of ground states. And transitions between ground states is what we call quantum phase transitions, right? What we will do later on in this course is to take this Heisenberg model, which has a, as we will see, it has an antiferromagnetic ground state. We will introduce some other interactions here and destroy that kind of order, and we will create some other kinds of ground states. And we are going to do calculations to see those transitions and study the properties of those other states. So maybe I still have time to discuss this slide, because that's going to be related to what Dennis is going to do in the tutorial today. So this will be the last page I'm doing today. So regarding the origin of these antiferromagnetic interactions, I tried to explain in some hand-waving way why we get this spin interaction S dot S. starting from some model of electrons where the electrons can move around. And this one can see in I think, a quite nice way. If you like, let's look at this Hubbard model that I wrote down before, so let me just go back to So this was the Hubbard model, right? You have the kinetic energy, which is jumping around those electrons, and you have the on-site repulsion mu. And from that, we get an effective interaction between spins. If we look at the situation of half-filling, meaning one electron per unit cell in this lattice, or let's say we start from this simple lattice, just the single band case. The simplest case one can look at is two sites. And we can solve those two sites, the Hubbard model on those two sites exactly. And one can see very nicely there that we get a spin interaction. So this is the Hubbard model on two sites. So one and two here corresponds to the two sites. So you should imagine two sites next to each other. And electrons have spin, right? So this is the kinetic energy for up spins, moving electrons back and forth of spin up, and this is moving the electrons of spin down. And the strength of this kinetic hopping term is minus T. And then we have the repulsion, so if we have two spins or two electrons on the same side, this is wrong. I did some copying and pasting, and apparently I forgot to do the editing of my pasting. So there should be N2 up, N2 down, of course. So that's the energy cost of doubling of the Viking sites. Okay, you will see this in more detail in the afternoon. But now we want to look at the two particle subspace. So we have as many electrons as sites. That's the situation where we get an insulator, a Mott insulator, and in the Mott insulator we get antiferromagnetism. So in that Hilbert space, in that subspace, we have six states, right? The four states with one electron on each side, and then two states where we have no electron on one side and two electrons on the other side, right? This is simple enough that we can actually diagonalize it exactly. Now, it's a little tricky because these are really Fermi. So when I write down states like that, I have to define these states as the vacuum and some electronic creation operators acting on that vacuum. And when you diagonalize it, when you write down the Hamiltonian, you have to be very careful with the signs coming from permuting fermions, and you will see that. So I just want to state the result of the calculation that we're going to do this afternoon. So what you will find is that, okay, there are six states, of course you get six eigenstates. Some of them are degenerate, so you get four different energies. And you can see here that we have some quantum numbers. So S is the total spin of these two sites. And in this subspace, the spin can be zero, meaning a singlet, or one meaning a triplet. And you can see that the ground state is a singlet. This P here is another quantum number which we will talk about today. It has to do with switching indices of it's a kind of reflection, but not excited reflection. So you see, the ground state is the singlet, and the first excited state is a triplet. This is threefold degenerate. There are three states in the triplet, of course. And the interesting thing here is this is plotted as a function of this interaction U. And you see when U becomes large, these two states are clearly separated from these two high energy states. And it turns out that these are your spin states. So if you construct an effective Heisenberg model, that's the model corresponding to these states. So the gap between the states, if you go to large U, so at large U, things simplify analytically, and you can see that this gap is 4t squared over u. So if you take the Heisenberg model S dot S with two spins, of course the ground state of that is the singlet if the coupling J is positive. It's a rotationally invariant interaction S dot S. So the eigenstates must be classified by total spins. The only possibilities is singlet and triplet. And was there a question?
No.
Okay. So it's exactly the same as here. The singlet is the ground state and the triplet is the first excited state. And if you actually look at the states, which you will do, the ground state looks like this. So this is basically the spin singlet, but then there's a mix in, of course, of these doubly occupied states. But you see that contribution is quite small when U is large, and if you compute the density of double occupied sites, you see that it goes down also basically as 1 over U. So when U is large, you have very few double occupied sites. And if you really take U to infinity, you will see that, of course, this vanishes and you are just left with the singlet. So when U goes to infinity, the ground state is a singlet, and this is the triplet. The triplet really always is just the spin state. You cannot have a doubly occupied site which is a triplet. The site with two spins on it is always a singlet. You will see that today. So. Okay, so that's really at the heart of quantum magnetism. Why you get an effective Heisenberg model as the low energy sector of an interacting electron system. In this case, the Hubbard model, but I showed you before a more complicated situation. This is a slightly more complicated situation where, okay, if we solve the smallest unit here, we would have three sites, we could do that as well, and you would find the same thing. Next time, I will just spend a little bit of time doing the perturbative derivation of the Heisenberg model from the infinite size lattice, not just looking at two spins. But the result will be the same. In the low energy sector, you have these spin states, and there's a separation by the gap to other states. Okay, well, I think that's where we will stop today. So, unless there are any questions, we'll continue tomorrow. All right.
So, my friends, the tutorial is 1:45.